Isaiah 4:1-5:17. The fifth talk in a series on the book of Isaiah was presented by David Crabtree on November 1, 1998 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1998. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Last time we looked at Isaiah chapter 3, and chapter 4 is actually just an addition to chapter 3. It carries on with the content of chapter 3. So let me quickly review what chapter 3 was about, and then we'll go right into chapter 4. What I've been claiming is that in this, at least in this early part of Isaiah, we've got three basic themes that Isaiah is repeating. And those three themes are, first of all, Judah has been in rebellion against God. It has been a subtle rebelliousness, because if you were to go up and ask the average person on the street of Jerusalem, are you a rebel against God? They're going to say, no way. But the fact is, deep down in their hearts, they are rebellious, stubborn, and refuse to trust God for who He is and follow His commandments wholeheartedly. So that's the first theme. The second theme is, because of that rebelliousness, God is going to punish them. And what's important to note about this punishment is it's not just punishment, but it's a refining punishment. It's a purifying, a cleansing punishment. That it is through this process of punishment, God is going to sort out where there is faithfulness, where there is responsiveness to Him, and where there is not, where there is hard-heartedness. And then the third theme is, at the conclusion of this purifying process, there will remain a remnant of Judah. And that remnant of Judah will have a glorious destiny. It will be truly something special. It will play a unique role in the history of mankind. Those three themes come up in chapter 3. In particular, what he's talking about in chapter 3 is he picks out two areas of rebelliousness within the society of Judah. The first one is the leaders of Judah, the people in positions of power, have been abusing their power and taking advantage of those who are powerless. They have used their power in a very self-serving fashion, and they have disregarded justice. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the women of Judah have been flirtatious, seductive, and arrogant. And so God, Isaiah here is proclaiming two punishments, and each punishment is directed specifically towards the offense. Because their leaders have taken advantage of their positions, Judah is going to be leaderless. That they will have to suffer under the leadership of children, essentially. It will be an arbitrary rule, a capricious rule, that they will have to suffer under. And because their women have been seductive and flirtatious, their women will be stripped of any outward beauty and be left alone, deserted. That's what's in chapter 3. Now we'll pick up in chapter 4, right at that point. Verse 1, for seven women will take hold of one man in that day, saying, we will eat our own bread and wear our own clothes, only let us be called by your name. Take away our reproach. So this is just concluding then, the punishment that's being proclaimed in response to the behavior of the women of Judah. They have tried to be seductive. They have tried to be alluring. Presumably, what they would like is to have men draping on their arms, following after them in herds. And what's going to happen instead? They will be seven women going after one man. That as a result of this punishment, it will be completely the inverse of what they would like to have happen. Now it's going to be seven women competing for one man and willing to do anything just to have a marriage, just to have a name, to take away their reproach. So God is going to give them just the opposite of what they've been seeking by their behavior. Okay, in verse 2 then, he turns it around and begins to speak of the destiny of Judah. That what I just mentioned was the conclusion of his describing the punishment. Now there's another destiny yet for Judah, for a portion of Judah. Starting in verse 2, in that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. And it will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem. When the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the bloodshed of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning, then the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day, even smoke, and the brightness of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory will be a canopy, and there will be a shelter to give shade from the heat by day, and refuge and protection from the storm and the rain. So at the other end of all of this punishment, a remnant will remain. And this remnant is described as the branch of the Lord. The branch of the Lord is an expression that we see several times in the Old Testament. And in most cases, it seems to be in reference to Jesus himself, the son of David, to the son of David, the line of Jesse, culminating in the Messiah, Jesus. But I think here it doesn't mean specifically Jesus. Ron made this suggestion when I was going through this section with him, and I think he's right. That the branch of David, the branch of the Lord. The branch of the Lord, the image here is, we've got this tree of some sort. And we have a bud or a sprout or something that's coming off of this tree that has real vigor and is growing. It's a subset of the whole organism, but this one has vigor and is growing. And so the branch here of the Lord, I think, is more general. It's that which remains. It's that remnant that has life. It's that which is really growing. So I think it means the remnant as a whole and not just Jesus here. Because it goes on later to say that this branch will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and adornment of the survivors of Israel. So the land is going to thrive under the management of this remnant, the survivors, the ones that remain after the punishment, the cleansing punishment that has been inflicted upon Judah. And this remnant will be characterized by being holy. They will be called holy. So having been through this cleansing punishment, we will have a group of survivors that will be characterized by their righteousness, by being truly devoted to God in a way that their predecessors had not been. And this will be when the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion. That's tying back to chapter 3, the behavior of the women. And purged the bloodshed of Jerusalem. And that, I think, is response back to the other crime listed in chapter 3. That is the abuse of power by the rulers. The abuse of power by the rulers is characterized as bloodshed. It's not just here that that is done. He did that elsewhere, if I can find it. I think it was in chapter 1. Yes. Chapter 1, verse 15. He had accused them, and in chapter 1 he had singled out their rulers for blame. He accused them of being rebellious and not valuing justice. And in verse 15 of chapter 1 he said, "So when you spread out your hands in prayer, I will hide my eyes from you. Yes, even though you multiply prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are covered with blood." So it doesn't just mean killing people, the blood, but rather it's being unjust towards one another. There are bloodless ways of killing people, but it's still killing people. We have all kinds of ways of taking lives. So it's that injustice, that indifference to their fellow man, I think, that he has in mind when he's talking about the bloodshed. So those things will be purged from the midst of the people of Jerusalem. And it says, by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning. That's how this is going to be done. So there is something about the way that God is going to administer this punishment that it will serve as a judgment. That is, it will draw lines between the just and the unjust. And a spirit of burning. This is curious because there's a number of references to burning in the purifying process. See if I can find them. Turning back to chapter 1, Isaiah 1:31. These are all just images that he's using for talking about what's going to happen. But he concludes chapter 1. With this image of the strong man, the man who thinks that who looks like he's got everything going for him, he's got it made in the midst of the people of Judah. It says, "And the strong man will become tinder, his work also a spark. Thus they shall both burn together, and there will be none to quench them." So here he's used the image of fire in respect to this cleansing punishment that will take place. Previously in the book, he also used it just as an image in that same chapter in verse 25. "I will also turn my hand against you and will smelt away your dross as with lye." Now that I read that, that may not be a burning, because that may be smelting with the chemical smelting. I take that all back. But then in 5:24. Hopefully this one works. 5:24, he uses the image of fire. He says, "Therefore, as a tongue of fire consumes stubble, and dry grass collapses into the flame, so their root will become like rot, and their blossom blow away as dust." We'll come back to that. But he likes to use this image of fire in talking about the punishment, this cleansing punishment that will come. And here he calls it a spirit of fire, of burning. I'm not sure what to make of that. We can maybe talk about that later. Then, what God says he's going to do is create over the Mount Zion, he's going to send by day a cloud, and by night it's going to be a flaming fire. And over all, his glory will be a canopy. Those should probably sound familiar. They should bring back to memory what happened in the story of the Exodus. That God, starting just before the Israelites went across the Red Sea, God sent a cloud by day, I'm sorry, yeah, a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. So I think the imagery here is designed to recall to the reader's mind those events of the Exodus. And the events of the Exodus are significant because that was the time in history in which God stepped into the affairs of man and acted overtly. God did a series of miracles, of very overt actions that were designed, he wanted to make his presence known. And he really put his stamp on that event as a unique event in human history. And what Isaiah is saying here, is alluding to here, is, I think, that will happen again. Once again, God will act overtly in history. Step in a way in which his fingerprints are quite clearly on the shaping of events. And that by doing this, God is going to provide shelter and shade and protection. Now, I've mentioned this before, I'll repeat it again. Something that's really curious about Isaiah is he doesn't seem to be giving us a timetable. That's not his agenda. He isn't being clear about this will happen at this point, and then this will happen at this point, and this will happen at this point. He isn't so concerned about chronology as he is about just restating his three themes. That Judah is a bunch of rebels. They are going to be punished, but for the remnant that remains, there will be a glorious destiny. But as far as putting it on a timeline, that does not seem to be part of his agenda. So when will this happen? When will it happen that the spirit of judgment will come upon Judah? The spirit of burning will come upon Judah? When will there be the cloud by day and the burning fire by night? He's not telling us. And I think we'll just have to wait on him until he decides, if he decides to make that clearer. Okay, that's the end of chapter 4. Let me pause to see if there are any questions or comments at this point, because we are going to... Chapter 5 makes a break, and we'll be starting into a whole different vision, in a sense.
Chapter 6 has the Isaiah with a bowl.
Yes.
Another
one of the burning. I could have listed several more. There are more coming up. But that theme, or that image of this spirit of burning is repeated many, many times. Good point.
I hate to ask this question because I feel like a feminist doing it. But I'm going to ask it anyway. Your image of men following after these women and herds, I thought was really funny. Just because when I see it happening, it looks really funny. And, and it occurs to me that women wouldn't be inclined to behave that sort of way if they didn't get a response, which means that you've got a corresponding something on the other end that responds to flirtatiousness and seductiveness and that kind of thing. And there's a good way to be attracted to beauty and that kind of thing. And that, but when you can't distinguish beauty from seductiveness, then there's a problem. And it appears that the men of Israel had a problem that corresponded to the women's problem. And I was just wondering why were the women singled out in this situation? And not the men.
Yeah. I pointed out when I... In chapter 3, both of the things, the offenses that he lists, one is the rulers abusing their power, and the other is the seductiveness of the women, the seductive behavior of the women. I think there are indications in the text itself that Isaiah is recognizing that those are societal problems, that it is wrong thinking to say that that is the women's problem, just as you say, because it needs that whole social environment that encourages them to engage in such behavior. Likewise, we can't pin the blame on the rulers either, because the rulers cannot abuse their power unless the people allow them to do so. So in both cases, he's picking out symptoms that are representative of a more general rottenness within the soul of the society of Judah.
Even in that culture, you said, I mean, in our democratic culture, it makes a lot of sense to say rulers, you know, we get the rulers we deserve.
Right.
But in that situation, they didn't have a whole lot of control over the rulers apart from, you know, absolute literal rebellion. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering, how could they have made it known? I mean, just be vocal about it and would be vocal?
That's the way I used to look at it. I'm convinced that that's not the dynamic that you have even in a monarchy, even in a hereditary monarchy. I mentioned this when I last time I taught. Tsar Nicholas I of Russia. His title was Autocrat of All Russia. He was the most powerful man in the world when he lived in the mid-1800s. He wrote complaining that he passes these laws, he signs these decrees, and he sends them out, and nothing happens. He says, what's going on? I'm the most powerful man in the world, and yet I issue these decrees, and nothing happens. The thing that we have to recognize is really no one has authority in human society that we don't grant to them. If all of his ministers, all of his bureaucrats decide that they don't want to implement one of his decrees, he can sign it as many times as he wants. It ain't going to happen. It's like the Queen of Hearts yelling, off with his head, off with his head, and they carry the guy off, and he comes back a little bit later, head in place. If you don't have someone to carry out those decrees, if you don't have someone saying, that's the king, and the king said to do X, therefore I'm going to do X, if you don't have a whole army of people doing that, it doesn't happen. So even in a hereditary monarchy, the leader can only go so far. If the people are unwilling to go in that direction, he's all by himself. It doesn't matter what number he comes in the dynasty. So we play a huge role in how our rulers rule, whether it's in a democratic society or in a monarchical society. We're much more like a herd than I think we would like to think.
Peter said that that probably his comment or his warning to the rulers is a symptom of a societal problem, not just the rulers themselves, but the fact that people are following these rulers.
Yes, or that people are allowing them to behave in the way that they're behaving. Yes.
Could you comment on what you think, maybe specifically what the rulers are doing and how the people are responding to the rulers?
Well, what the rulers are doing is taking advantage of the powerless.
Right.
They aren't...
they're not being fair or just.
Right, they are not being just. That it's, he gives several examples, and he will continue to give examples of ways in which rulers have been unjust, especially towards the poor, the widows, and the orphans.
Okay.
That they are taking advantage of them for their own self-serving purposes.
Okay.
So they are becoming wealthy at the expense of the powerless.
And so the people at large, the general population, is allowing that to happen.
And I think you can certainly see it in our society. If our rulers will do what we will allow them to get away with, And it's I think it's more apparent in a democracy than it is in a monarchy, that we choose rulers in a sense in our own image. We the things that we value is what we insist that our rulers value. It's quite curious right now in our situation that for years we have been electing people to office, to go to Washington to represent us, on the basis of what kind of goodies they will bring to their home district. So we have been electing those who are the most self-serving. Now we're asking them to make a principled decision. Ain't gonna happen. Because we haven't been electing those who are principled, because we don't value principle. So we will elect representatives according to what we value. And although you don't have elections in a monarchical society, I'm convinced a similar dynamic takes place nevertheless. That the leadership ends up being a reflection of the moral character of society as a whole. Otherwise, people don't grant authority.
I'm kind of getting a picture that you could almost say that God's saying, look, you people have trashy relationships, so I'm going to crush your town. Right? I mean, your women are acting like Philistines, and the men are acting like wives, and you're turning your social relationships into a joke. And so I'm gonna bring an army down to just burn your towns, kill your children, haul you all to slavery.
Yeah, they have been living lives which have, in a sense, been slowly doing what God is going to do quickly. There's this theme that runs through Genesis. I know I've mentioned this before, but we want one thing and we pursue it in our own independent fashion. And in so doing, we manifest a great deal of rebelliousness towards God. We decide, I want this, I'm going for it, I know how to get it, God, stay out of my way. God's response to that attitude on the part of man is to say, I am going to condemn you to failure at getting that good thing that you are seeking. And we see that here. The very thing that the women want, they aren't going to get. And the rulers are going to become slaves, taken away in chains.
So I'm flashing on the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus is saying, you know, you worry about this just like the pagan, and it's not going to change a thing. And you want this thing just like the pagan, and it's not going to change a thing. Rather, you should be like these. You should be like this. You should want this, and you should want that. Nothing's changed in that, you know, 1,400 years or whatever among the people. And again, he crushed them. Is he saying, I want a people that looks like this, whose homes look like this, whose relationships look like this, so much, I'm going to destroy the whole thing if they don't? So these people could be running through a lot of the forms correctly. I don't know, it's just not going to change anything. Destroying the people is not going to change anything. Burning their houses down is not going to change anything. I mean, I was thinking about this last night, is that no matter what God does, it doesn't change the basic problem. All he can do is create fences around their behaviors and say, stay within these forms, and I won't burn you to the ground. But they're going to be in those forms, wishing they could be out of those forms. So nothing's really changed at all.
But Isaiah's third theme here is that something will change. That out of this process, you're right, for the vast majority it will change nothing. But out of this process will come a remnant. And with respect to that remnant, there will be change. This process is going to bring about a few survivors that will truly embrace God, that will honor his laws and will be called holy.
Not because that's what they are, but because he has saved them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like God's going to unleash a fatal venereal disease into the population
He says, okay, you guys that don't do it, you're going to live. And they're not going to not do it because they're such beautiful people. They're not going to do it because God has changed their heart.
Right.
He has changed the external contingencies. He's changed their heart, which is the ultimate message of the Sermon on the Mount.
Right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Chris, did you have a question? Okay, let's look at chapter 5 then. In chapter 5, we have the organization is as follows. We begin with this metaphor that he lays out, that Judah and Israel are like a vineyard, and God is like the vintner. And he's going to elaborate on that a little bit. Then he's going to list two woes. Woe to certain kinds of people. And he's going to say what kind of people and what kind of punishment is coming for them. Then he's going to list a series of other woes and a rather general punishment at the end of the chapter. So let's look at the metaphor in verses 1 through 7. He says, "Let me sing now for my well-beloved, a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill, and he dug it all around, removed its stones, and planted it with the choicest vine. And he built a tower in the middle of it, and hewed out a wine vat in it. Then he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones." So that's the basic image that he's working with, is this vintner who begins with a good piece of ground. It should work. He does everything right. He plants it right. He puts the hedge around it. He puts the walls around it. He builds a tower to protect it, I assume. And he even creates a wine vat in preparation for what's going to be produced in this vineyard. But what happens? He expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones. So despite all of his efforts, this vineyard turns out just bad apples or grapes or something. Okay, now he asks the rhetorical question then in verse 3, what should I do? He says, "And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? So now let me tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will break down its wall, and it will become trampled ground. And I will lay it waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up. I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it." So he's saying, okay, I've given you this metaphor for the vintner and his vineyard. What should the vintner do in this case? So he's asking this rhetorical question. And then he says what his response is going to be. Essentially, his response is going to be to withdraw all of his protection and care from it. The hedges will come down, the walls will come down. He's not going to hoe it or prune it anymore, so it'll be overwhelmed by briars, which, if it's anything like our place, will take about a year. And he will charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. So he's going to withhold his protection and care from it. And it's going to be destroyed. That's what will happen. It's interesting that by saying, "I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it," he's kind of stepping out of his metaphor a bit here. The vintner can't do that. So he's kind of stepping out. And then in the next verses, he tells us full-blown how this metaphor works. He says, verse 7, "For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his delightful plant. Thus he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress." So God is the vintner. Israel and Judah are the vineyard. And he expected righteousness. What did he get? He got bloodshed and cries of distress. I assume what he means is cries of distress on the part of those people who are being oppressed, taken advantage of by the rest of society. So that's his image, and it's I think a powerful image. Now he's going to talk about what is he going to do more specifically. What is analogous to taking down the hedges and the walls? And he's got this divided up into woe to someone for something, and this is what's going to happen. Woe to someone else for what they did, and this is what's going to happen. And then he's going to give a whole list of woes and a more general punishment. The first woe, verses 8 through 12. Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until there is no more room, so that you have to live alone in the midst of the land. In my ears, the Lord of hosts has sworn, surely many houses shall become desolate, even great and fine ones, without occupants. For 10 acres of vineyard will yield only one bath of wine, and a homer of seed will yield but an ephah of grain. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may pursue... Oops, I'm sorry. That's a different woe. I got my woes mixed up. Okay, the first woe is to those who add house to house and field to field. So it's in response to those who are greedy. They're just accumulating these huge estates, probably at the expense of others who have less resources. In any case, this is an interesting picture. You've got this person who's buying up all the land around his house and just keeps buying it up farther and further around. And pretty soon, what do you end up with? Somebody's stuck in the middle of this piece of ground with nobody else around. He's all alone in this big plot of land. His wealth has isolated him. And what will happen? Those houses, even the big houses, are going to be vacated by the scourge to come. Even they will be empty. Doesn't matter how big they are, they'll still be empty. And no matter how big that farm, no matter how many acres they've tacked on, it won't produce. 10 acres of vineyard will yield only one bath of wine, and a homer of seed will yield an ephah of grain. I'm not sure, but I think that's going downhill. You're planting more than you're reaping. So, in response to the greediness of the people of Israel, of Judah, what is going to happen? Punishment will be inflicted, which will isolate people and take away their wealth. Okay, second woe now, verses 11 through 12. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may pursue strong drink, who stay up late in the evening that wine may inflame them. And their banquets are accompanied by lyre and harp, by tambourine and flute, and by wine. But they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hands. This is my favorite woe. We've got the picture here is people who they get up early in the morning so they can start drinking, and they stay up late so they can continue drinking. These are people given over to drink, obviously. Now we've got the other, and their banquets. They've got lots of music and they've got wine at those banquets. What are they doing? Well, they're doing this instead of, but they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hands. I'm going to steal a phrase from Jack that I like very much. He has said that mankind is divided into two groups, junkies and philosophers. And there are only two groups. That is, We are either given over to distraction, or we take seriously wanting to know what's true. That's the only two kinds of human beings there are. You can divide them into those two groups. And here, the people of Judah are being denounced for being junkies, for being given over to distraction, rather than paying attention to the deeds of the Lord. This is... Let's think back to what the first image that he presented here. The first image is that God went out and he prepared this vineyard, did everything that he could to make this vineyard turn out right. And what's happened? It's turned out poorly. How are Isaiah's listeners supposed to identify with that? Where's this vineyard? I mean, you can kind of listen to them. You can think their thoughts as they're hearing what Isaiah is saying. They're saying, where is this vineyard? Where is this hedge? Where is this wall? Where is this, the reality that's being described by this image? I mean, is God really here acting in Judah? I haven't seen him. Like Yuri Gagarin, he went up in space and didn't see God. Well, the people of Judah are looking, I don't see him here. I've never seen him pruning here. I've never seen him mending the fences here. Well, the reason they haven't seen him is because they haven't looked. The reason they haven't seen him is because they have not considered the deeds of his hands. They don't want to see them. They aren't attentive to them. How could they see them? One way that they could see them is to look back at their history. God did act in their history in a very overt fashion in the Exodus. And God acted overtly as a monument, something that they could look back upon and remind themselves of who God is and what his relationship is to the people of Israel and Judah. They could also look to the laws that were given to the people of Israel and reflect upon the nature of those laws and what it tells us about God and what he's up to. But that was all in the past, and we know how the past fades. There's just, the past doesn't really impact us like the present. As human beings, we are really focused on the present. That's just the nature of things. How can they tell in the present? Well, if they were to look around them in Judah at the time that they were living, their very existence was, in a sense, miraculous, because they were a very small power in a world of potentially big powers. Egypt could easily have crushed them. Egypt had a much... was much wealthier and was capable of producing a large military force. But during the time in which Israel came into being until the time of Isaiah, Egypt had been so preoccupied with its own social problems that it hadn't been able to get its act together and become a world power. The same thing was true of the other traditional powers in Mesopotamia and even the Hittites up to the north. So there were societies that existed that, if they could get their acts together, could easily have crushed Israel. But they couldn't get their acts together. Why not? Israel was lucky. The hand of God was on them and was preserving them. Those are the fences and those are the hedges, but they couldn't see him. They weren't attentive to it. Furthermore, if their lives were anything like mine, they could have seen God in their own individual experiences. I have marveled of late at the little things that God has done in my life that are, on the one hand, they're incredible, but on the other hand, they're very forgettable. We had a day a couple weeks ago when my wife and I went to bed with in a great deal of anguish because we had two insolvable problems facing us. And we couldn't figure out any way to address them. We couldn't think of anything to do to solve either one of them. So I went to bed feeling rather sick and went to bed praying about that situation. It's just an anguishing situation. The next day, I woke up and the problems were still there and just as anguishing. But over the course of the day, both problems just kind of melted and were non-problems. Now, those problems, the funny thing about being a human being is at the moment that something like that happens, you are so grateful. You think, that is fantastic. But it's only a matter of hours until there are new problems that come in, and what your feeling of thanksgiving has dissipated. And so you've got new problems. The other thing that happens is, well, they would have kind of dissolved on their own anyway. They really weren't as big a deal as I was making them, etc., etc. But in fact, God is active in our lives constantly. At least that has been my experience, that I can see God working. The thing that's aggravating is he doesn't solve them the way I want him to solve them. And very often, the problems are just eased for a time, only to come back again later and later. But that seems to be God's way. If we look back to the Exodus, there's another image I want to draw from the Exodus that has been really significant in my thinking in the last few months. And that is, the Israelites were in the wilderness with no food. It was a desperate situation. And what did God do? He provided them with manna. That was a very bizarre way to take care of that problem. If I had been one of the Israelites, I know what I would have wanted. I would have wanted a guarantee of long-term provision, not day by day, but long-term, and a more varied diet. He's not providing for them in high style. He's just keeping them alive day by day by day. It's just kind of that limping along, stumbling along, but making it. God is not averse to that. It's very rare that he comes in with the year of gourmet meals laid out for us. But rather, it's just what you need today and tomorrow, just what you need. My problems is, as I face them on a day-to-day basis, God rarely comes in and zap, it's gone. But about 3 days after the pain is unbearable, he'll ease it. It's always 3 days. And then it comes back, and then just take the edge off of it, just the edge off the pain. The pain doesn't go away, but just the edge, just enough to say, yeah, I can do this day. And then face the next. But it's very important, I think, for us to be cognizant and appreciative of the care and provision that God does provide, to pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, and to consider the work of his hands, rather than trying to distract ourselves from the problems that face us moment by moment. Okay, what is God going to do in response to this second woe? Verses 13 through 17. Therefore, my people go into exile for their lack of knowledge, and their honorable men are famished, and their multitude is parched with thirst. Therefore, Sheol has enlarged its throat and opened its mouth without measure. And Jerusalem's splendor, her multitude, her din of revelry, and the jubilant within her descend into it. So the common man will be humbled, and the man of importance abased. The eyes of the proud also will be abased, but the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment. The holy God will show himself holy in righteousness. Then the lambs will graze in it as in their pasture, and strangers will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. Because the people of Judah have given themselves over to dissipation and not considered the works of God's hands, what will happen? They will go into exile for their ignorance. But their ignorance is a willful ignorance. They choose to be ignorant. They choose to give themselves over to dissipation, distraction. Their honorable men are famished. Their multitude is parched with thirst. So there will be the deprivation of the things that they need. And Sheol has enlarged its throat and is going to swallow Jerusalem's splendor and all the revelry and the jubilant. So everyone is going to be humbled. The common man and the important man are all going to be humbled, but there will be one alone who will be exalted at that time, and that is God. That in this process, God alone will be truly exalted and be shown for who he is. And the end result in 17 is lambs will graze as in their pastures, and strangers will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. So what's going to happen is the area will be deserted of the people of Judah. What will be there in the place of Judah is that lambs will graze as in their pasture. So these are apparently lambs from elsewhere. And strangers will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. So the people of Judah will be removed into exile, and foreigners will take that place. Okay, I better stop there and finish up.
Talking about what you're talking about God trying to do here in Isaiah and Exodus, finally, there's change the picture of what the social environment looks like. You come up with a basically pure kind of piece to work with. And in every case you look at it, it seems like it didn't work. It doesn't, the solution never lasts as long as the preceding problem or as long as the next problem is facing. So, what's the point then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the answer is the time is not up. That process is still happening. And that in the end, a remnant will survive out of this process. And that remnant will truly have been transformed. And just one point of clarification. It's true that what God wants to create here is a society that is just. But the key to that is creating hearts that seek justice, that seek what is right and what is good.
So you're actually talking about two facets, the process and the remnant. Process, that you should see something progressively getting better, or distinctly looking different,
right,
as opposed to a remnant, a subgroup that may not be visible at all, but is always there.
Yeah. Well, several summers I painted houses to make money. And one of the things I liked about painting houses is you started out by making the house look really bad. And then just after it looks its very worst, very quickly it starts to look very nice. So a process doesn't always happen in a steady improvement. That sometimes a process goes like this. And my guess is that that's the kind of process we're looking at.
Would it be appropriate perhaps not to look at it on a societal level and just look at it personally? It's only affect a person while they're alive, and then we deal with the next group to come along, kind of on a spiritual basis.
Sure. I think that that is happened, that there is that aspect to it, that God is working in the lives of individuals. And that probably over the whole history of Israel and Judah, there have been individuals that in whose lives God has worked and transformed their hearts. I'm confident that that's true. But what he's describing here is, for the most part, he's talking about a societal transformation that's going to happen. And there are people who will have experienced these punishments that will never be changed by that. Their hearts will never be transformed. But they've created this legacy that, in my understanding of history, is all going to lead toward a situation in which we'll have a societal transformation. When I was a freshman in college, everybody on my floor in the dorm except for four or five were Jews. And one of the things that really surprised me in talking to them is they were very proud of their Jewishness. They held to it tenaciously. Why? Because 6 million Jews died just because they were Jewish.